All right, we are still at Emerging Languages Conference. Please introduce yourself.
I'm Jonathan Edwards. I'm a visiting researcher at MIT, and I just gave a talk here on my latest brainstorms / fantasies about the future of programming.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, it was a really, really interesting talk, first of all.
Thanks.
And let's dig in as much as we can, you know, a little bit into what it is. So take us through what's going on here.
Okay, well, for, you know, a working programmer, I would say that, and I've done a lot of work as a programmer myself, but kind of the key problem I'm trying to address is input. Right, so we write these interactive applications. They talk to people, and either from a desktop platform or now over the web, and now we've got phones and tablets and whatever. But you know, it's complicated. And what I've noticed is that the really painful part of it is the input side. Right, it's pretty easy to slap some data, build a data model, slap it up on a screen, render it, whatever. But it's when you're reacting to user input that it gets messy, because user input comes in lots of forms and lots of order, and we have a lot of layers of software in between us handling that input, feeding it to us, especially on the web. Mm-hmm. It's got all these forms coming in, and you know what's evolved are these complex systems of callbacks and event processing, and basically callbacks are hell, you know, in my experience, right? Because I mean, in the simple case, it's okay, but in general, you get these callbacks coming at you. You don't know when they're going to fire. You don't know in what order they're going to fire, and you're hitting on state, and they're just corrupting each other. You know, there's this Sean Parent at Adobe did publish some results from their apps that something on the order of a third of their bugs came from just that callback, that input side of their apps. It's really a mess because what we've taken is what's essentially some inputs that we want to respond to, and we've turned it into this giant asynchronous machine with stuff firing off and gears turning, and it's all asynchronous, and you know it's incredibly complicated. And the reason we've done that, though, is that the control flow is really, really complicated on input. You've got a lot of different things firing off, and you want it to be modular. We have a model view architecture, and so the view is supposed to be insulated from the model, and so you want to have the view firing events somehow on the model and then reacting to it. And it gets to be a mess, basically. You know, what order do the events come in?
Sure.
You know, so that's kind of the real pain point, but and we've developed very complicated frameworks, which as long as you live, breathe, and think that framework, you're good, right? But it's a lot to learn, and there's a lot of gears under the surface and sharp edges poking out at various times. And I'm really thinking about the future, and to me, the whole problem is really, really fundamental, and it's imperative sequential programming. And, you know, when I look at this problem, I see it again in a minor form in all kinds of code that we write with side effects. And I have these silly little examples in my talks about how in 10 lines of code, you know, just with one little property setter method, you can just get all bollocked up and unclear about what's going on with side effects. So the thing is that we're still basically programming in assembly language. That everything we do is the programmer is in charge of ordering events pretty much completely, saying what's going to happen in what order, and in control of reads and writes to memory. And you got to make sure that if you write to memory, that any read that depends on it happens afterwards and not before. And if you don't want to see what that write did, you better do the read before. And this can be complicated to guarantee in a very large system.
Sure.
Side effects are, you know, on theoretical grounds, known to be a really big problem. They break modularity, and so people have tried to get away from them. But it's really hard to avoid side effects when you're handling input, because what's input? Input is a side effect, right?
Sure.
I mean, the user's doing something, and you need to change the state of the system. That's a side effect. So it's kind of hard to get around it.
Sure.
And so we have. So there's a lot of popularity now with functional programming. And pure, you know, true, pure, hardcore functional programming has no side effects. Essentially, the only thing you can do is recreate the entire state of the entire program on every input. And there's all sorts of ways to make it simpler than that. the functional reactive programming is a currently popular approach to that. But I find that I just can't get my head around that. It's a sort of an inside out to me, where you've got to figure out, you know, at the point in the model where it's going to modify, you've got to say, well, what are all the events that could possibly hit me? And how do I multiplex them together if there's more than one event that could hit me? And that's just backwards. I mean, I'm just like simple, concrete ways of thinking. And to me, it's your change in state. I mean, that's a nice model.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going back and thinking some, going back to the beginning, kind of, and say, is there a way we can write a programming language that still lets us modify state in a sort of naive, intuitive way? Because that is a very intuitive way to think. But can we do that without having to do all this low-level worrying sequencing of operations? Let the compiler do that for us. That's what compilers are good at, right? Mm-hmm. But humans aren't particularly. So, and this is called declarative programming. You know, and what I define it as is declarative programming is programming without a program counter. Hmm. Right? The program says, do this stuff in some notation, in some semantics, but there's no idea of, well, the program's at this point, and then it's going to go to that point, and then it's going to go. There's no program counter, there's no control flow. You aren't telling the computer what order to do things in. It figures that out for you, right? And that's great, because then, you know, it can put it on a multi-core machine if it wants to. It could distribute it out to the cloud. It's got a lot of freedom at that point. And you've offloaded the human programmer from having to worry about all that low-level stuff, all these side-effecty bugs.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, these kind of languages have a data flow flavor to them. So I'm just asking the question, well, why can't we use data flow programming to build Microsoft Word?
Yes.
And the reason, which I don't think is widely appreciated, is because of pointers.
Mm.
When you go in, and that it's a basic result in computer science, that pointers, when they point to the same object, that's called aliasing, right? And you can't predict ahead of time. The compiler can't predict when two pointers might be pointing to the same object.
Okay.
Generally, there's been tons and tons of work in computer science on solving that problem, but there's no simple, clear, total, complete solution to it.
Mm-hmm.
So in general, then, if you're going to use pointers, which are real handy because they let you build complex data structures, I mean, objects are pointers to other objects, right? Once you start doing that, declarative programming kind of goes down the tubes, right? Because the compiler can't figure out what the data flows are based on what you're writing and what you're reading, because if you're writing or reading through a pointer, oh my gosh, they could be aliased. Every pointer of a certain task, they could all be pointing to the same instance, and then they're all talking to each other, and that makes no sense. So, but maybe we can't solve this problem in general, but maybe we can sidestep it by limiting the use of pointers. So that's what I'm working on, is an idea of changing our data model of hobbling or making pointers hygienic so that they can't ruin the ability of the compiler to predict data flow. And if we could do that, then our compilers get a lot smarter, and we can stop worrying about control flow, and we can just program with data flow.
So now, what is your take on essentially imperative frameworks and runtimes? I mean, clearly, 99% of .NET, for example, it's imperative programming. C# is an imperative language. With F#, now we have a little functional stuff going on, certainly not pure functional. What's your take on that? Because, I mean, you can write very powerful systems without ever thinking about pointers as a composer at the composition level. What's your take on that? I mean, certainly, based on what you just said about pointers making compilers dumb, etc.
Well, so you are thinking about pointers all the time, because every time you do new, right, you're getting a pointer to an object.
Fair enough.
Every object-type field in another object is a pointer to another object. Sometimes they're called references, which is a more highfalutin term for it.
Okay.
But basically they're pointers. It's just an abstraction, a thin veneer of abstraction over a memory address.
Mm.
Objects are contiguous hunks of memory with pointers to other contiguous hunks of memory. And we're still programming in assembly language, even though we've chunked it up a little bit now, so the pointers can't point to anything. They're typed, and they only point to the beginning of the object instead of any byte in the middle of it, but still pointers.
Okay.
So they're all over the place. And What you find is that if you want to use functional programming or if you want to go to things like state machines, you end up having to throw out objects. You end up in functional languages, it just becomes trees. You know, and trees are pretty limited. You can't build like a double linked list in a tree. You can't do that in a pure functional language. Now, you'd have to escape the pure functional and start doing imperative again, which is what they do in practice. But you were asking, you know, so the mainstream is imperative, right?
Yes,
and of course there's a big kind of performance reason for that, a big historical reason that that's where the technology is and we're evolving, and frankly I'm looking over the horizon.
Yes.
This is not something that's going to ship next year, okay?
Of course.
But, you know, someone's got to be thinking about this.
Yeah.
All right, what other paradigms could there be that would make it easier for us? Because we have enormous horsepower we could throw at this. We have enormous theoretical advances we could throw at it. And so I'm just trying to re-ask some of those questions.
So let me ask you a question on that too, man. I mean, here we are at the Emerging Languages Camp, which is part of OSCON. And it occurs to me that, and I've noticed this at, you know, JAU, which is a great event that happens in Aarhus and also in, I think, not San Francisco, but anyway, I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole. The point is, it seems that... programming languages are about, 60, 70 years old? And there hasn't been a tremendous amount of evolution, I mean, and I've covered a fair amount of this on Channel 9. You seem to be in this cycle of... and so what you're talking about is sort of breaking out of the comfort zone. And so I'm just trying to wrap my head around exactly what, essentially, model view declarative programming would look like, I mean, for an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
So you're down at the very low level. You haven't gotten up to the level where I'd be composing. But it, you know, since we're talking about the future, I mean, what would it look like? I mean, unfortunately, you can't show us, but maybe you could talk to us a little bit about what that programming would look like.
Well, to be honest, I don't know either.
Fair enough.
So I'm at the point here of, you know, I mean, I think we're in a desperate position here because you're right. You know, we really haven't made much progress in programming, really. And functional programming, I think, was this valiant, you know, wonderful effort to say, hey, you know, let's rethink some things. I'm disappointed with the results. I think that it gets us a certain way there, but it's not the solution.
Agreed.
Personally, my personal opinion, there's plenty of people who are all for it. The problem with functional programming is that, you know, it is a solution, but you have to learn how to think in a totally new way, and that's not only is it just a new way. I think, in some basic sense, it's unnatural that you have to think in a much higher level of abstraction, and especially when you want to handle input, you got to just turn your mind inside out and sideways. And maybe, you know, we'll breed programmers that can think that way. Maybe if we start teaching them when they're five, we'll get there. But, you know, the way I think when I'm programming doesn't work that way. And to me, the job of programming language design is to come up with a language that normal people can use, right?
Yes.
Right. The goal is, this is really a usability issue, right? A programming language is mostly a tool that people use to express themselves, express ideas in software, and communicate those ideas to other people. And we have to design this media to match up the way we think. It's got to be intuitive and natural, although I can't define what those terms are. So I'm casting around here. I've run a whole series of experiments along this, and some of them have failed. And so this is my latest one, is to actually drill all the way down to this basic idea from the original architecture of the computer, that what you're doing is you're sequencing reads and writes. And I'm thinking about that again. And so my approach to getting that under control is to say, okay, well, we've got to step away further from the memory model, and we have to give up on the idea of a heap of objects. Instead, I have a tree of objects. Objects are nested inside each other. And what this gives me is a sense of location now. It's because objects are now located in a tree, and collections go in this tree too. So it's a variable size tree that grows and changes shape. But there's always a relative path between any two objects in the tree, and I know a lot about that path at compile time. So now that gives me much more information than I have about just objects anywhere in memory.
Okay.
And the other And then I add on to that binding between objects, which is a instead of sharing objects by pointing at them, it's create multiple instances and make bindings between them that connect up. And the advantage there is that you don't have to worry about these pointer aliasing things. You've declared exactly when things are going to be equal or not. Mm. And finally, to make this work, the idea is to adopt a model view architecture. Because the kind of programs that I've always been building are structured that way. So I'm just going to say, okay, this only works for that kind of system. Mm-hmm. But that's a lot of software, right? It's basically anytime you're talking between a human and a database, you've got a model view architecture going. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to work for signal processing or, you know, predicting global climate. Those are different kinds of things. But for interactive apps like Microsoft Word or Amazon.com or, you know, things on a phone, mm-hmm. right, that's appropriate. And I'm going to bake that into the language semantics, is that models and views are built into the language and that there's a, the compiler works out a data flow from the view into the model back down to the view. It's just what we're used to, but mm-hmm. instead of you having to choreograph that whole thing with all these methods, you know, the observer pattern and all that, it's all just baked in.
Excellent. I mean, that's a great vision.
And all I'm doing is I'm just stealing from practice, right? It's because what people, real engineers do, and this is what the science has often progressed, right, is that, you know, they look at what the engineers have actually discovered in practice and mm-hmm. said, oh, I can write a formula that captures that. Mm-hmm. So people have built these very elaborate model view frameworks mm-hmm. with fancy concepts like binding things. Mm-hmm. And I'm just saying, well, you know, this is what works. Let's build a programming language whose semantics is the model view architecture that we've been using in these frameworks, and then get rid of all the low-level plumbing that we had to build before in order to build that framework.
Interesting. Now, do you think, that based on sort of the current computer architecture, do you think this model will work? I mean, without having some hardware changes or the ways in which... I mean, you mentioned earlier, that's my question.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm not sure I can answer that because I don't yet really know some fundamental questions about how much of a runtime layer I've got to add. Mm. But I am talking about a compiled language. So there is the potential there that the compiler is going to be able to just come up with the linear code, mm-hmm. right? It's just a much fancier kind of compiler.
Okay.
But it's still going to emit machine language.
Sure.
At the bottom level, a certain order of events that happen. Mm-hmm. It's maybe going to be doing some more copying. It's going to have some very sophisticated kind of memoization techniques probably. So I don't know how it's all going to shake out, but mm-hmm. it seems to me feasible. You know, it's in the realm of possibility that it actually is competitive, performance-wise.
Excellent.
But even if, I mean, I'm sort of willing to, look what we've done with Java, right? Mm-hmm. All right. So if we found something that actually made a difference, that would actually help programmers get their jobs done, mm-hmm. I'm not sure we've found any silver bullets really that do that. But you know, in the incredible case that we did, well, you know, what if it's 10 times slower? Well, that's no problem, is my opinion. First of all, there's a lot of apps that could afford to be 10 times slower. Mm-hmm. And if you really improved life for programmers, you've gotten such a big win there that you could afford to invest the money in improving the performance. Mm-hmm. Right? And generally, if you look at the history of most languages, particularly Java, it's a function of throwing money and people and time at it. You know, just put some good engineers on the job and pay them well, and let them solve the problem for you, and it'll get done. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of more of a socioeconomic issue.
Sure. I mean, in C# and the .NET.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I don't mean to put down C#. It's been similar curve.
Sure.
I mean, there was a time 10 years ago when people in Microsoft would have just scoffed at the idea of, you know, doing apps in managed code, right? Mm-hmm. But now you're actually on the verge of doing it, I understand.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, there's lots of, I mean, the, you know, the ASP.NET is pretty much the biggest success story for managed code. Mm-hmm. It makes perfect sense in that environment. It's very productive. But again, C# is, like Java, you know, C++ minus all the things that people, that C developers, like was mentioned today in the talk,
yep.
C developers adopted C++ because of the crap that Java removed.
Right, but the key to competitive performance there was realizing that there's a lot of smarts we can put in compilers these days and virtual machines, right?
Yes.
Right? We can, we have the technology now. It used to be, I mean, kind of we are where we are now because a lot of design decisions were made back when just writing a parser was an incredible achievement, right? Mm-hmm. That was a hard, really, really hard thing to do, and compilers were really hard, and the machines were so slow that they had to be very simple in order to run fast enough, and we were forced to build languages that were easy to compile. Mm-hmm. That's no longer the case. We can step away from the machine model quite a longer ways than we have now and compile away the difference, you know. And I think the idea of JITs in the JVM, and now there's even fancier stuff people are working in, you know, with trace-based
yes.
compilation, shows that, you know, smart engineers working in the compiler and the JVM can do a lot. And if you can do that, what we should be doing is making the programming language easier to use for a programmer.
Agreed.
Right?
I mean, I've often wondered that when we talked about sort of... I mean, concurrency is an interesting example because there's no compiler smart enough to be able to go, oh, I'll take this random code and I'll easily parse it out and be able to take advantage of these 1,000 cores. And
right.
It can't happen like that, right? I mean, that would be ridiculous. And a virtual machine can't do that as well, but... one of the things it seems like we've learned from Java and C# is that the programming language is just a really thin veneer over a vast library of functionality. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could say the same for C++ as well, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you have the STL, ATL, blah, blah, blah. Lots of libraries. In your world, how would you be able to access libraries not written in your...
foreign functions.
And this is way too... I mean, it's not a fair question because you're still dreaming and envisioning, but in reality, no software system really operates in isolation from other types of code, right? Theoretically. So
I haven't really thought about that because, mm-hmm. I'm so far away from that being a problem. You know, if that was my problem, then I've succeeded incredibly
Fair enough.
But I don't see any reason why there's anything fundamentally wrong. I mean, you know, at some point you black box that stuff, mm-hmm. and you say, well, if this is well understood, you know, the runtime libraries are verified or at least
sure.
highly tested, and therefore we're just going to trust them sort of as a low level thing, and then you wrapper them into whatever your new language is, in a way, you know, opening it up to arbitrary, you know, C code is more questionable.
Sure.
But
excellent.
You know, paths of evolution. I mean, that's stuff I really it would be, you know, quite egotistical for me to even speculate how that is. You know, my only goal is to just ask some questions that maybe haven't been asked for a while.
Yes.
Right, and re-ask them and look at them again and with mm-hmm. fresh eyes, mm-hmm. and maybe come up with a slightly new, different answer.
Good.
And trigger some other people to realize that this is worth. You know, I'm sure that my answer is not the right one, but if it's close enough, everybody else will be just jump on top of me and fix it. You know, so and then the way these things go is 30 years later it'll get introduced into the mainstream, right? Like garbage collection and stuff like that. But that's better than nothing, so.
Sure. Very interesting. Well, hey, good luck to you.
All right, thank you.
And great to meet you.
Yeah, thank you.
Awesome.
Same.
And let me just ask quickly, where can people find out more information about this? They want to keep track. Do you have...
All right, so my blog is alarmingdevelopment.org, and that's sort of my permanent home base. And my current language site is called coherence-lang.org.
Okay.
And from there, you know, pointers will
awesome.
Lead to
And
everything.
Those links will be in the description text, and if people watching
of course
this can just click on it.
There's not much there currently, and it's all of a theoretical nature, but...
That's fine. Well, maybe you'll find somebody who watched this and might have an idea.
Yeah. Yes.
You know?
I get all kinds of input from the net all the time.
Perfect.
All right. Excellent. Been good talking to you, Charles.
Great. Take care.
Yeah.